Proposed responses to climate change range from the simple and easy to the complex and far-reaching. As these efforts get underway, it's important to go in with our eyes open to avoid doing harm in our quest to do good. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, produced with USAID's Office of Conflict Management and Mitigation, we interview experts about backdraft, the unintended peace and conflict consequences of climate change responses. I'm Sean Peoples, and today I'm speaking with Ken Konka, Professor of International Relations at American University, about how conflict is not always bad and cooperation is not always good. Ken, thank you for joining me today. First, I want to get a sense from you about your interest in water and water politics and governance. What got you started in this issue, and why is it so interesting to you?
Well, I originally got interested in water because as somebody who's trained in international relations and in international relations theory, water is really interesting. We tend to construct the world in spatial terms, and we tend to create these categories, sovereign nation states. And we tend to look at international relations as the interaction among these relatively stable spatial units. Water problematizes that in all sorts of ways. I mean, water is very unpredictable in its flow. Water flows. It moves across boundaries. It's very difficult to make water sit still for governance. Water can be moved from one basin to another, but only at great cost and often at great political contention as well. And so as someone who was interested in the ways that the international system was changing, in the ways that sovereignty was changing, in the way that states were having to develop new practices to deal with problems of global interdependence, I thought water was a great entry point for trying to understand that.
And from the beginning of that time of interest and then to practice, how have some of your ideas changed over the years?
One of the things that I think I quickly came to realize in studying the transnational dynamics around water was that it's important to recognize that conflict is not always bad and cooperation is not always good. I think there's a bit of a bias in the field toward wanting to see cooperation, almost wanting to see cooperation at all costs. Cooperation becomes the end in and of itself. One of the things that I very quickly realized around water was that the principal way of creating new practices around water in the world, of creating new norms around water in the world, was through contentious social conflict. And so when I started studying water governance, water policy, international water law, one of the things that I noticed was that many of the actors that were real catalysts for change were actors who resided outside the system, local communities, activists, emerging transnational networks of actors who didn't embrace the main precepts and premises of elite institutions and mainstream policy, and sort of forcing their way into the conversation. And as someone who studies conflict, I was interested in that as a manifestation of social conflict. But one of the things I started to realize was that it wasn't just about conflict. It was that their conflict was actually generating new norms, new ideas, water as a human right, the importance of protecting the environment, the rights of local communities, the idea that something like a government building a large dam was not just a local matter between that government and its people, that it was a global issue, that it had larger ramifications, and that people who hadn't been part of participatory political processes were sort of pushing their way in, creating conflict in the process, but doing it in a way that was actually quite productive in terms of better policies and improvements.
Do you feel it's hard to discuss the idea that conflict is okay sometimes and cooperation isn't always something that's going to get you what you think you need? That seems like for some practitioners that go against what they're told to do, what they're sure expected to do.
Sure. I think there's a couple of important things to stress about that. One is you're dealing with a very complex system, multi-level, multi-layered, multi-dimensional. And so often what happens, particularly around water, is that cooperation in one part of that system or on one level of that system can often just lead to conflict byproducts in other levels. So, for example, there's been a lot of efforts in international diplomacy over the last 20 years or so to promote cooperation in shared river basins. There are something like 276 river basins in the world that either cross borders or form borders. A large proportion of humanity lives in those river basins. And there's a general perception that as water grows more scarce, as climate change kicks in increasingly with urbanization, with industrial growth, those shared river basins are real potential flashpoints for conflict. So the World Bank, for example, will not lend money in an international river basin under normal circumstances unless there is a cooperative agreement in place between the riparian nations in that basin. Well, that's a good practice as far as it goes, and cooperation is very important. But under those circumstances, there's a danger that cooperation starts to become the end in itself rather than simply the means to an end, and it's really important that we look at the content of that cooperation. If that cooperation is around modernizing the basin, building a lot of infrastructure in the basin, trying to discipline and master the flows of water in that basin, that may in fact be robust cooperation from the point of view of the countries. But if that imposes a whole set of new challenges and adjustment costs on local communities, that are accustomed to living with the ebb and flow of the river, then essentially what you're doing is you're creating cooperation in one portion of the system and pushing down the adjustment costs and triggering conflict in another portion of the system at the same time. So I think there's a danger that we start to simply, you know, tick off, we've got another treaty. That's a good thing, without paying enough attention to the content of some of those agreements.
Some of this sounds very reminiscent of the backdraft idea where...
Sure, absolutely.
So how did you come to this idea of backdraft, where there's unintended consequences, where you're trying to do the best you can with some of the information you have? Maybe you are ticking the boxes, but you're not thinking through what the consequences are on a bigger level.
So I first came to this because I was very interested in the emerging research and the emerging conversation and the emerging discourse around the idea that climate change would trigger violent conflict. And, you know, recognizing the possibility of that, I've long felt that much of that narrative, not necessarily the research, but the way that people talk in policy circles about the problem, is based on some flawed assumptions. Basically, the idea that scarcity begets grievances, begets conflict. And actually, that's not really how conflict works. There's a lot more to it than simply scarcity and grievances. And I'm not sure that the principal consequences of climate change, certainly in terms of water, are scarcity. There are places that are being subjected to absolute water scarcity, and it's a real problem. But it's the uncertainty and the variability that is triggered by climate change that, for most people, is the larger challenge. You know, we droughts, flooding, and just unpredictability and increasing challenges in planning. The phrase they use in water circles is stationarity is dead, which basically means that we won't be able to plan for the future based on our understandings of the past. So I was drawn to the idea of backdraft because, to me, the central premise of backdraft is there's as much conflict potential in the policies you embrace and in the adaptations and in the adjustments to the problem that you make as there is in the problem itself. So climate change may trigger conflict, but adaptations to climate change, policies to address climate change, may also trigger conflict. And it seems to me that's a very powerful insight. And it's quite consistent with this thread running through my work that I spoke of earlier, where not all cooperation is good and not all conflict is necessarily bad. And so that's one reason why I've been very interested in backdraft. Another reason why I'm very interested in backdraft is because climate change is really leading to a resurgence in interest in large-scale water infrastructure, in hydroelectric dams, in irrigation dams, in water storage, for a couple of reasons. One is that dams are perceived to be, it's not always the case, but dams are perceived to be very friendly from a greenhouse gas point of view. They're a non-fossil fuel source of energy. And second is that with all of the variability that climate change promises for the water sector, having the ability to store large amounts of water is perceived as a very good thing because it can kind of smooth out some of the uncertainties. You can release water in the lean years and so on. And so I saw a real marriage between the conflict potential of climate adaptation and a lot of the work that I had already done on water infrastructure and large dam projects as well.
Is there a specific example that we can pull out on the dam side?
So, the first thing I would say is it wouldn't only be large dams. Right? I mean, one of the, you know, there's challenges of, you know, cities reworking their water infrastructure for managing stormwater and wastewater and drinking water. There's disaster risk reduction and attempts to kind of retool coastal zones through combinations of gray infrastructure and green infrastructure. So there's a lot of adjustments in the water space that are driven by climate change that that entail really, you know, trying to change the landscape and how the landscape intersects with water. That involves large amounts of infrastructure. Infrastructure is always contentious. Infrastructure is always controversial. Infrastructure always creates winners and losers. If you look at what's going on in New York City right now and in the area around New York City in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, there's been a real recognition that we need to start moving toward a more resilient approach to storms, to disasters, toward living in coastal regions. And you're seeing a lot of infrastructure being built. You're seeing green spaces being created. You're seeing flood walls, retaining walls, all sorts of infrastructure being created. Well, that has enormous consequences for neighborhoods. It has enormous consequences for property values. It has enormous consequences for who is being protected and for who is not. And so if one of our responses to living in a climate change world is going to be to rework our infrastructure around water, then we're inherently going to be creating controversies. We're inherently going to be in the space of conflict. We're inherently going to be creating winners and losers. Large dams are a particularly prominent and compelling example of that. So let's just look at the Mekong River Basin as one specific example. It's a very economically dynamic region. There's a lot of demand for energy. You've got a lot of people moving into cities. You've got a lot of people moving from rural agricultural livelihoods to more urban manufacturing and industry-based livelihoods. And as a result, the governments in the region have had a strong interest in building hydroelectric dams, particularly triggered by the purchasing of power, the agreements to purchase power in some of the bigger urban centers in the region. Thailand in particular has been signing power purchasing agreements with its neighbors. And so that's one part of the push. The second thing is that the Mekong is a very wild and untamed river. It's a very seasonal river. There's this sort of ebb and flow. And you've got people living in the basin, particularly more downstream in the basin and in the Delta region, whose entire lives and livelihoods and cultures are sort of organized around the ebb and the flow of the river and the time of the year when they grow rice and the time of the year when they fish, and so on and so forth. And so there are two ways of thinking about how to live in that basin in a climate change world. One is to try to, you know, exercise human mastery over the river, to control the flow of the river. China has built several dams upstream in the upper reaches of the Mekong. And the Chinese argument is that these are highly beneficial dams because they will smooth out the flow. They will make it more predictable. They'll make it possible to deal with the lean years and the flood years and the different times of year of water availability in a more reasonable sort of manner. The second way of trying to live in that space is to just sort of, you know, acknowledge the uncertainty, embrace the uncertainty, and think about planning, think about infrastructure, think about people's livelihoods from a starting point of, you know, what are flexible and robust and most likely quite decentralized responses to the changes that we're seeing. And these two approaches are essentially at war with each other today in the Mekong. On the one hand, you have governments gathering together under the auspices of the Mekong River Commission and with a lot of transnational investment and financial capital and building dams and other forms of infrastructure to really master the river and control the river and extract electricity generating power from the river. And arrayed against that, you have a broad coalition of civil society actors who think that that's not the way to go.
The Nile River Basin is often cited as an example of great conflict potential around dams and infrastructure. So how does that connect to your way of thinking about conflict and cooperation in international river basins?
The Nile is an interesting case because the way the problem is usually constructed is as one of water scarcity. So you've got a dozen countries arrayed up and down the two forks, the Blue Nile and the White Nile, with the confluence point at Khartoum and then flowing down through Sudan and into Egypt. Historically, Egypt has been the biggest user of water in the basin. It's been the most powerful country in the basin. There's a whole body of colonial era international law that guarantees Egypt, and then later Sudan added on its independence, guarantees Egypt and Sudan the lion's share of the water rights in the basin. This has become a point of contention for the countries upstream, who were not even sovereign independent states for the most part when that colonial era law was agreements were created. And as they have started to develop infrastructure and want to make war use, they've wanted to kind of shift the balance of the distribution of water rights in the basin. Ethiopia in particular has been very aggressive about building water storage capacity in the form of large dams upstream. In ways that has made Egypt understandably quite nervous. So one way of looking at the problem in the basin is that it's simply one of water scarcity. There's a fixed amount of water that's available, and the more that countries upstream store and use, the less that there will be. And scarcity begets grievance, begets conflict. And so your model of the dynamics in the basin is that this problem of a fixed pie distributed in a zero-sum manner leads to tensions between the countries and leads to things like Egypt threatening to blow up the dam project in Ethiopia, although there's some question as to whether Egypt would really have the military capacity to do that. I look at the basin very differently. I see a basin where two of the five or six largest hydroelectric projects in the world, the Aswan Dam and the under-construction Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, are being built and will be operated in a totally uncoordinated manner by two separate countries in the context of growing demand for water, of growing urbanization, and of climate change. And so rather than seeing a sort of a logic of zero-sum scarcity leading to tensions, I see us conducting a sort of a very scary experiment in real time with whether we really have the ability to master this basin and manage the flow of water in this basin. And so for me, that is not to say that there will not be tensions between Egypt and Ethiopia, because clearly there have been. Although at the same time that Egypt has threatened to blow up the dam, Egypt has also offered to invest in the dam project. And so that just shows you that it all comes down to, you know, the way that the managerial scheme will work out, the way, you know, governments have a way of, you know, finding a cooperative space if they perceive that there are benefits to be had and profits to be had. So even if that turns out to be a conflict problem in the basin, to me, the much larger conflict problem in the basin is going to be, what's going to happen to the livelihoods of millions of people as we conduct this real-time experiment in water mastery in a greenhouse world? And so that really is more about governments' capabilities being taxed by a whole new set of social demands at the same time that some of the effects in the basin are undermining those governments' very capabilities. So it's a little bit more of a death by a thousand cuts concept of the conflict risk in the basin. There are some forms of cooperation between the Nile riparians, and in particular between Egypt and Ethiopia, that would help to manage that conflict problem. But there are other forms of cooperation between those states that could make that conflict risk actually worse.
At a practical level, how do we move forward to deal, to adapt?
So in thinking about how do we sort of live in this highly uncertain world and how do we make decisions? I mean, it's easy to say that project doesn't make sense, this approach doesn't make sense, that policy is unlikely to work, but we do need to make decisions and try to move forward in the world. I think there are a few principles that really have to, take center stage. The first is there's a very, very powerful argument for decentralization in that sort of reasoning. And so rather than thinking about a single project that is going to optimize or maximize benefits, I think we really, really need to think about a much broader suite of responses. There is no silver bullet. There is no magic solution. And we really need to keep our options open. Second thing that I think is critically important is that we step back and remind ourselves, what are we really trying to accomplish? Often, because the technology of these projects is so complex, because putting the financing together for these projects is so challenging, because simply pulling off the project is so challenging, the projects become an end in and of themselves. And, you know, governments attach great symbolic significance to being able to pull off these, you know, colossus projects and so on, and that just adds another layer to it. I think it's important to step back and say the real question here is, what are the water needs in this basin? What are the energy needs in this basin? And how are we going to achieve them in a sort of low-cost and robust and flexible manner? And if we take that approach and start to pit the more familiar kinds of responses to some of the new kinds of alternatives that are out there, to solar, to wind, to renewables, to small-scale hydro, you start to see, to water conservation, you start to see many, many more possibilities. And the third thing I think we need to do is we really need to take seriously the idea of conflict sensitivity. We're just now starting to develop some tools that can be used to really stop and think in the early days of projects about the conflict risk. The U.S. Agency for International Development has developed a whole series of toolkits over the years, land in conflict, minerals in conflict. And the most recent of these is a toolkit on water in conflict. It's really instructive to compare that toolkit to some of the earlier tools that they developed, because it really shows the evolution and the improvement in the improvement in the state of the art. And one of the points that USAID's water conflict toolkit makes is that there are positive peace building opportunities in these projects as well, that we need to tap. And the other is that these projects don't have a chance if they don't embrace and recognize the fact that there are different interests here. There are winners and losers, and managing those conflicts needs to be a central part of project design.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.